solar and wind technologies were much more expensive than they are today. So they used to be much more expensive. So it used to be much more expensive to generate, you know, a 1 megawatt hour of electricity using solar or wind than it did from a coal or gas-fired conventional power plant. That's no longer the case today. And in fact, it's often in many places cheaper now to produce electricity from solar or wind facilities than it is from a coal-fired power plant, for example. And the view out there has been that, well, now that we've achieved that kind of cost parity or even cost advantage for renewables, then the economics are resolved. We don't have to worry about the economics anymore because we've achieved this kind of price parity. And my argument in the book is that that's a complete misconception and it actually misunderstands the drivers of renewables development and the nature of electricity markets.
The era of global warming has ended. The era of global boiling has arrived.
The cost of renewable technologies, wind turbines, solar panels, batteries, have been falling far quicker than anyone expected.
We currently have about 7,000 kilometers of long-distance transmission network in place. We need to add another 4,000 kilometers.
You're proving simultaneously that it is the best job creator when you go green.
We want food security. We don't want to swap that for energy security.
What happens next is up to every one of us.
The price of renewable energy has plunged dramatically in recent years. Now, the cost of a unit of electricity produced by renewables is comparable to, or even cheaper than, that produced by coal, gas, or nuclear. It all suggests a rapid transition to green energy and the demise of fossil fuels, right? Wrong, says Professor Brett Christophers of Uppsala University in Sweden. According to Professor Christophers, there's a big flaw in the argument about the favourable economics of renewables and the view that it's only the politicians and NIMBYs who stand in the way of the end of fossil fuel power generation. The problem, he says, is that while renewables appear to be cheap and getting cheaper, they may not actually be profitable. The point, he says, is that generating costs are only part of the green energy cost equation, and there are other major costs involved, notably the cost of the space required to site the renewables, the cost of the transmission infrastructure, to transmit it to where the demand is, and then there is the cost of storage, if the power generated cannot be used immediately. Stacked against these costs are revenues and profits which are more volatile than those faced by the operators of coal, gas, or even nuclear plants. And on top of that, the subsidies and tax incentives available for renewables are less generous than those available to fossil fuel or nuclear companies. The upshot of all this is that the transition to renewable energy generation is less rapid than anticipated and may even slow further if the economics become less favourable and investment more unattractive. Returns on renewable investments are typically in the 5 to 8% range, which compares with returns generally in excess of 15% for oil and gas production. In a nutshell, Professor Christophers believes governments must take the blame for this situation, for expecting the private sector to take responsibility for substituting clean for dirty energy. Instead, they should take on the burden of renewables development through public ownership, public financing, or by compelling private firms to build renewables. It's all pretty thought-provoking stuff. So, without further ado, let's join Professor Christophers in his office at Uppsala University to delve further into his views on why green energy growth is stalling and what the solutions might be.
Brett Christophers, welcome to the Business of Weather podcast, Road to Zero.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Right, Brett, can we start by asking you to say who you are and your areas of research and expertise?
The first question is easier to answer than the second one. So I am Brett. I work at the Institute for Housing and Urban Research at Uppsala University. I'm a geographer by both training and, I guess, inclination. And while I'm based at an Institute for Housing and Urban Research and have done and continue to do lots of research on cities and housing, I've done research ranging much more widely than that as well. I have very kind of Catholic research interests. I'm basically interested in pretty much everything there is about capitalism present, future, past. I guess in recent years, most of my research has been focused on questions of ownership, I suppose, asset ownership under capitalism, under contemporary capitalism. So ownership of assets like land, assets like natural resources, infrastructure, as well as housing, and how patterns of ownership have been changing in recent decades. And what those changing patterns mean for questions of, you know, economic growth, questions of inequality, questions of productivity, and so on. And then more recently, questions of energy and energy transition in relation to climate change. So that's a brief background. And I think it's fair to say that the focus of my work that is to do with climate and energy has kind of emerged more or less kind of organically out of those existing interests in questions of asset ownership and changing patterns of asset ownership.
Okay, let's pick up on the energy angle now. Now, in your new book, The Price is Wrong, Why Capitalism Won't Save the Planet, you argue that there's a widespread misconception about what's needed to expand the use of renewable energy and speed the transition away from fossil fuel generation. Can you summarise as briefly as you can what this misconception is?
Yes. So what I'm trying to do in the book is displace what I find to be very convincing array of explanations for the pickle we're in with regard to too slow a solution to the climate crisis. What I'm really trying to do is add a new angle to those explanations rather than kind of dismissing them out of hand. Because what I believe and what I argue is that one of the main obstacles to a more rapid transition away from fossil fuels in the power sector and towards renewables has not been talked about enough. And so there are lots of good arguments out there for why the transition is going too slowly. The one I'm trying to add is fundamentally an economic argument. And as I say in the book, there is the misconception that is out there is plainly stated is essentially that the economics of the transition have been solved. And what I mean by that is the argument there is that, yes, there are remaining obstacles to faster rollout of renewables and to more rapid decarbonisation, but that those obstacles are all or mostly of a non-economic nature. They're about kind of bureaucratic obstacles, planning hurdles and so on and so forth, and I'm sure we can get back to those. But there's a basic misconception, I think, that the economics have been solved. And the reason or substance of that misconception is that, look, the economics used to be a problem, used to be a concern when solar and wind technologies were much more expensive than they are today. So they used to be much more expensive. So it used to be much more expensive to generate, you know, one megawatt hour of electricity using solar or wind than it did from a coal or gas-fired conventional power plant. That's no longer the case today. And in fact, it's often in many places cheaper now to produce electricity from solar or wind facilities than it is from a coal-fired power plant, for example. And the view out there has been that, well, now that we've achieved that kind of cost parity or even cost advantage for renewables, then the economics are resolved. We don't have to worry about the economics anymore because we've achieved this kind of price parity. And my argument in the book is that that's a complete misconception and it actually misunderstands the drivers of renewables development and the nature of electricity markets in the electricity industry.
I mean, in your book, you talk about the big issue being the profitability of investing in renewables, not just investing, but owning and operating them as well.
Yes.
So what is the problem with the profitability of something like this, which is it's as cheap as chips to build a power station? Why isn't it profitable to operate?
Well, I mean, I think the best way of me to answering that is to say that there are two main arguments about profitability that I make in the book, and an argument specifically about the profitability of renewables. And they are related to one another, but they're different. And I think both of them constitute problems. So the first of those is not so much about the level of profitability of that business. It's more about the volatility of profitability in that business. And what I mean by that is that the level of revenue available from operating wind and solar farms over a period of 10, 15 years or whatever it might be, and selling the electricity that they generate. So the level of revenue available from that, and in turn the level of profit available from that, are typically very, very volatile, and that volatility represents a significant hurdle for developers trying to raise the necessary finance to develop a wind or solar farm in the first place. Because what happens is that typically renewables developers, you know, the likes of you or I, for example, who wanted to set up a new solar field of solar panels and sell that electricity. Most cases where that happens, whatever the scale that occurs on, developers try to raise debt finance to do that. So borrowing money is the main way in which that type of business is typically financed. Now, if you or I was to go to a bank and say, look, I need 100 million crowns or 100 million euros or whatever else it is, in order to buy the turbines and install the wind farm or whatever else it might be, what the banker would do would probably say, well, that sounds like an interesting proposition, but if I lend you that money, how do I know that you're going to be able to pay the interest on the loan and pay back that debt after a certain period of time? And I would say, well, I'm going to sell the electricity. And the banker would say, well, what price are you going to sell that electricity at for the next 10, 12 years, or however long it's going to take you to earn enough money to pay back that debt? And I would say, oh, I don't know. And the reason I don't know is precisely because electricity prices in the types of markets where most renewables companies sell their electricity, which is wholesale electricity markets, is very, very volatile. And that really concerns bankers because they want to see that you're going to be able to pay back that debt. And in the renewables industry, profitability is very, very volatile. And for reasons that I can get into if you want to, but we don't necessarily need to, profitability is more volatile for renewables developers than it is for the operators of, say, a coal or gas-fired power plant. And that's a problem for getting renewables developments off the ground. And in fact, I argue in the book, it's the main problem. So if, say, 100 companies are contemplating setting up a new wind or solar farm, and let's say 5 of those 100 proposals ultimately come to fruition, the main ground on which the 95 that fail will fall afoul will be on not being able to raise the necessary.
So this is different, say, if we take Sizewell C, let's look at the big nuclear station, which is still in the making, in theory anyway. They are getting a guaranteed price per kilowatt hour.
Yes.
So this is lacking, is it, in the renewable market?
Well, that's the thing, is that in order to raise finance, renewables developers essentially always, let me say almost always, have to find a way to fix their output prices over a long period of time. There are mechanisms to do that, of which government support has historically been the main one. It's not the only way you can do it. But the problem is that there are not enough reliable opportunities for that price fixing out there to enable more renewables development than we are seeing at the moment. There's a limited quantity of sources of that price fixing, but you're completely correct. There are sources available, and that price fixing has historically been and continues to be absolutely essential to getting most renewables projects off the ground in order to mitigate that volatility that scares off financial institutions. So let me before you come back in, let me carry on a minute. So volatility is one thing. That's one thing. But it's not the only problem, and it's not the only thing that is a hurdle for the renewables industry. The other thing is that profitability is not only very, very volatile, it's typically quite low. And so it's very hard to generalize about this because, of course, as I've just said, profitability varies across time a lot. It varies geographically between different countries for all sorts of different reasons. But let me say, on average, historically, returns in this business of developing and operating wind and solar farms and selling the electricity they generate would typically be in the kind of 5 to 8% range. Now, that might sound to your eye, that's a pretty healthy level of return, 5 to 8%. But let me say two things to kind of disabuse potential objections to this. Well, yes, 5 to 8% might sound quite a lot. But firstly, let's think about where potential developers of renewable power are coming from commercially. And let's think in particular about big oil and gas companies that have been encouraged, cajoled, told by various constituencies to move into the renewable sector. Well, in the oil and gas world, the BPs and the Exxons and the Chevrons and so on and so forth, they normally don't get out of bed unless returns are pretty reliably going to be above 15%. So for those types of companies to say, okay, we're going to move out of oil and gas with our 15% returns and move into renewables with 5, 6, 7, maximum 8% returns, you have to be kidding, because it's simply not a rational economic proposition for them to make that shift while they continue to believe that they can generate those types of returns in oil and gas exploration and extraction. So that's the first thing. Second thing to say is 5 to 8% perhaps sounded good 4 or 5 years ago when interest rates were 0 or 1%. But 5 to 8% probably doesn't sound so good when you can get 5 or 6% by simply putting your money in the bank account or in treasuries or another risk-free investment. Why take that risk in order to generate only meager extra returns when you can get those returns risk-free? And actually, let's also say that those higher interest rates that now look like a better proposition, they are actually making the renewables business much less profitable because the cost of capital has gone up. So profitability is generally low, and I'm more than happy to talk about why that is. Like, why is this a low returns business?
Just want to digress a little bit here.
Sure.
Now, Shell, ExxonMobil, etc., etc., they have shareholders.
Yes.
Now, their main shareholders are not people like you or I.
No.
They're institutional investors, pension funds, life funds, and they want a steady flow of income to pay their liabilities to their pensioners,
correct,
their life insurance policy holders, etc.
Yep.
How influential, how important are the institutional investors when it comes to the choice to stay in the fossil fuel domain, perhaps, which is more profitable, or go into the renewable domain, which, as you say, is less profitable?
Yeah.
How important are those institutional investors in the decision?
I think they're reasonably important. I mean, I think that they, these are huge questions, and there's an enormous amount of research that's done on these questions about how influential they are. There's quite a lot of disagreement in the kind of scholarly literature on these questions, I would say. And it, let's also say it's a fast-moving terrain. Things are happening really fast in this area. I would say just a couple of things, and not everyone probably who does research in the same field would agree with me. My sense is this. First of all, I think they have less influence than some people like to believe, those shareholders.
Even though they own the company.
Yeah, because they don't... in general, even the biggest shareholders own stakes that are relatively small. So the biggest of them, the BlackRocks and the Vanguards, might own 7 or 8% at most. And not only that, but they tend to own them through an array of different funds with different managers, and the idea that they're all kind of singing from the same hymn sheet, I think, is misconstrued. And these are also, the bigger the shareholder, the more passive those shareholders typically are. They are shareholders that own stakes in 20 or 30,000 different companies, and they're not actively engaging in all 20 or 30,000 different companies. Their business is passive investment with very low fees, and so they're not active investors. So my view is that those big publicly owned companies, like you mentioned, are actually run by the board, and that the board runs those entities with much less external influence than many people like to believe. That's the first thing I say. Second thing I say is that while many of those external shareholders sometimes talk a good game on climate and ESG and so on, again, my sense from watching this field for a long time and doing research and reading other research is that when it comes to the crunch, financial returns and kind of fiduciary duty around maximising returns to their own investors, pensioners and so on, almost always trumps those ESG concerns. And actually in the US, if not in Europe, there's been a kind of a backlash, as I'm sure many people will have heard about, against quote-unquote ESG, environmental, social, governance investing, where the backlash has basically said, look, we've gone too far on the ESG front, not far enough, and we need to row back and focus much more exclusively on financial returns. So my sense is that the ability of the likes of executives at the likes of Shell and BP and so on to say, no, we're going to actually just focus on financial return, and for now at least that means oil and gas, I think they're more than capable of doing that.
Let's just return now to the renewable energy sector, so to speak. Now, if your argument about profitability is correct, then why is there a huge waiting list, certainly in the UK, of developers seeking to build solar farms who are unable to do so because there's insufficient grid capacity to take the electricity they could produce?
Yeah.
Now, according to the Times newspaper in May 23, solar farm developers have been told that they will have to wait until as late as the 2040s to connect to the local electricity grids, which the Times says is delaying £20 billion of energy projects.
Yeah.
So why this huge waiting list if the profitability isn't particularly good?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that there's probably at least three important answers to that question. So I think the first answer I would say is that the first answer is one you've almost given already, which is that the grid can't cope with all of that new development. So the transmission and distribution grid in the UK, but not just in the UK, I would say globally, is creaking.
It's everywhere, isn't it? Australia, the United States,
absolutely.
Europe.
It's creaking. It's creaking for all sorts of different reasons. Lack of historical investment. It's creaking because of... in many parts of the world, massively increasing electricity consumption as lots of countries modernise and industrialise and urbanise and so on. And it's creaking not least, and this is very, very important, including to the argument I make about profitability, it's creaking because of the geographical character, the typical geographical characteristics of renewables themselves, which is that they tend to be disproportionately located very, very distant from where demand for electricity consumption is located, which is to say where people don't live. And so the demands on the grid have been exacerbated by the shift towards forms of energy generation that are typically located much further from centres of demand than conventional power plants are. And most of that, not all of it, but a lot of that has to do with the cost of land. So renewables are much more land intensive than conventional power plants are, which means the cost of land is disproportionately more important. So you, other things being equal, you have a very strong incentive to base yourself where land is cheap, which is where people and industry aren't found. So that's the first answer. There's a long waiting list because the grid can't cope without the necessary investment to upgrade it, which is typically not happening. I think the second answer to that question is that those reports, and I've read lots of those reports, in my view, and I've seen evidence for this as well, they talk about developments, the number of developments that are waiting in line. Many of those developments are incredibly unlikely to see.
Applications.
They are shots in the dark by people or entities that haven't even begun the process of seriously considering everything that needs to be done to become a renewables developer. And I quote this, some of this research in the book, but there's good research that shows, you know, something like 70 or 80% of those applications simply aren't serious applications. So I think that's the second thing. But I think the third thing, which I think is very, very important, is that I think in the renewables business, there are many, many developers out there, many of them small developers, many of them very entrepreneurial, who are quite prepared to take the risks of developing a business that potentially might not end up being as profitable as they might hope. That might be because they have serious climate concerns and wanting to do good for the planet. It might not be the only consideration, but I think that is often the consideration. And so I think for many of those developers, there is this entrepreneurial spirit where they are willing to take those risks, even if, and many of them might not know that profits are potentially limited in this run, but even if they do know that, they're willing to take the risks. But here's the thing, is that the financial institutions that they require to back them are not willing to take those risks. And as I hinted at earlier, the decisions that ultimately, the commercial decisions that ultimately determine whether those developments go ahead or not, are not the ones made by developers themselves. They're the ones made by the banks that either...
Or by shareholders if they're equity funds.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Yes, there are loads of developers out there waiting, but the prospect of all those developers, or even a majority of those developers, ever raising the finance necessary to enable them to secure that grid connection and begin to generate electricity is very, very, very limited. So I don't think that long queue that you refer to is in any way kind of mutually incompatible with the argument that I make in the book.
Yeah, okay. Now, I just want to look at some of the barriers to renewables in a little bit more detail. Mm-hmm. The barriers that you're talking about are the ones which stand in the way of a more rapid implementation of renewable energy. Now, reviewing your new book in February, the FT posed the question, why is it so difficult to wean renewable energy off public support?
Yeah.
Now, the FT noted that your answer to this isn't to do with the relative power prices, but with the profitability of renewable energy projects compared to the profitability of fossil fuel projects.
Yeah.
I think you say an average renewable project earns just 5 to 8% on equity compared to more than 15% for oil and gas.
Yeah.
But what are the reasons for this? I mean,
yeah.
There's a lot's been said about the hidden subsidies for fossil fuels, the tax breaks, the tax credits, whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
Which they say, no, these are tax credits, they're not subsidies, but they
are
subsidies.
It's a form of subsidy.
It's just another
Absolutely.
Form of subsidy.
Yeah.
So how can this situation be addressed where there is an apparent bias towards fossil fuels? How can this be addressed so that renewables, if they don't have an equal bias, at least the bias is taken away, the tax credits are taken away from and the fossil fuels, which make them so profitable.
Yeah.
In your view, how can these the support structures be changed so renewables are more favoured than perhaps fossil fuels are at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult question to answer. My sense is that lots of the support mechanisms that exist for the renewables business right now are actually pretty good. I think, and I would say that particularly about the types of support mechanisms that have historically been the most common across in Europe, by which I mean the types of long-term power purchase contracts that we touched on a wee bit earlier, which go by all sorts of different names because they all vary slightly in how they're structured. So feed-in tariffs, feed-in premiums, of which contracts for difference are a very good example. Those are, I think, pretty much gold standard support mechanisms. They do what developers and, in theory at least, they do what developers and their financial backers want. I think they are much more effective mechanisms than the types of tax credits that are used in the US to support renewables development. What you tend to find in the US is that tax credits are never enough, and that developers have to find other forms of price stabilization.
Which is the root of the Inflation Reduction Act, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so that's that. And so I think, I don't have a real problem with the types of support mechanisms that we have in Europe. My issue is that I think there should just be more of them. I think that, instead of offering X number of contracts for difference per annum a certain amount of new gigawatts of capacity, just more of that needs to be done more rapidly is the first thing I would say. But the second thing I would say, and I'll come back to the fossil fuel side, I don't want to forget about the fossil fuel side of the equation because you talked about this earlier, but the second thing I think about, as well as more of them, I think the other thing I would say, and this relates to your question about why it hasn't been possible to wean renewables off these support mechanisms, is that I think there needs to be a better understanding of the economics of the industry. And let me explain what I mean by that. So there was long a presumption, which I think still exists in certain circles, but it's a presumption that my book is arguing against, which was that as the cost of the renewables technologies came down, as the cost of solar cells and wind turbine technologies came down, then it would be possible for governments to reduce or even remove those support mechanisms and renewables would be able to stand on their two feet. But what the evidence shows is that hasn't proven to be possible. And everywhere in the world where governments have tried to substantially reduce their subsidy mechanisms or even remove them, investment in renewables has completely collapsed, precisely for the reasons that I explain in the book. And if you think that's counterintuitive, costs come down, surely profit should go up, I can explain in due course why that isn't the case. The mere point I want to make now, though, is simply that as well as doing more of this subsidisation, it has to be done with a greater understanding of the economics of the industry. And the UK is a classic case of this. So last year, as I'm sure many people will know, in the UK, there was an auction for new offshore wind contracts for difference, fixed prices, where there were zero bidders. And it was because the government imposed a ceiling on the potential price of that purchase contract that was completely unreasonable. It showed no understanding of the economics of the industry and of the fact that lots of the cost of the industry had gone up, financing costs, supply chain costs, and so on. So as well as more, there has to be a greater awareness of what are very real profitability constraints in the industry. And that awareness is not there at the moment. And the book is partly about trying to highlight that awareness of that profitability constraint. So more support and better awareness. On the fossil fuel side, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that, to say, as I do in the book, that renewables are still ubiquitously dependent upon renewables is not to say that fossil fuels aren't The fossil fuel industry isn't itself saturated in subsidies. It is. They're very different types of subsidies. They tend to be more on the consumption side than the production side, which is very, very different from renewables. But nonetheless, the subsidies are still there. And of course, one way to... the alternative way of maximising the competitiveness of renewables is not necessarily to boost support and subsidies on the renewable side, it's to reduce support and subsidies on the fossil fuel side. Absolutely, that's possible. But the only point I would want to make there is that is the reason it doesn't happen for the most part, which is because it's politically unpopular, because if it means prices at the pump go up, consumers cry foul. I mean, consumers hate higher electricity prices, but I think they hate higher gasoline prices even more than high electric prices, not least in the US, which is why you have this absurd spectacle of President Biden on the one hand, you know, extolling the virtues of the Inflation Reduction Act supporting renewables, but on the, you know, on the exact same day telling OPEC to increase production of oil and gas to keep the price of gasoline down in the US. So it's completely contradictory.
Can the electrification of transportation deal with this issue?
Potentially, but it's not happening anytime soon.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Now, just want to ask you a question about the electricity markets, the way they're organised and the impact this has on the uptake of renewable energy. The electricity markets are currently organised in favour of fossil fuels. The price is determined by gas, because that's the one that provides most peak of power.
Yes.
That's the cost at the margin.
Yes.
Now, there's been talk about reorganising the electricity markets to take into account renewables, the growth in renewables. But as far as you see, how important and what role do electricity markets play when it comes to the uptake of renewables, and what needs to change?
Yeah, so the structuring of electricity markets is crucially important. I think it would be, you can make a bigger generalisation than that, right? You can say that for any new technology that comes along in any industry, the way in which that industry is structured, the way in which commodities that circulate in the industry are bought and sold, has huge implications for the potential of that technology to break through. Does the way the industry is structured favour or disfavour incumbents versus new entrants and so on and so forth? So absolutely it makes a big difference. And for sure, the way in which most electricity markets around the world are structured, and it varies quite a lot from place to place, has a huge impact. It's very difficult to generalize about this, but I think the way I would answer to that question is to say that for many years now, mainstream energy economists have indeed been saying, look, the problem that renewables face is the fact that we have a system of commercialization of electrical power, ways of buying and selling electricity, that was conceived in a fossil fuel world and designed for a fossil fuel world, and that essentially those market designs have not been reformulated to accommodate renewables. And I have a certain degree of sympathy for that argument. It's basically an argument that says, look, the problem we have is not the market. The problem is not the fact that we're relying on the market and the private sector to drive the energy transition. The problem is that we haven't got our market design right. So it's a very kind of mainstream economic argument.
So how do we redesign it?
Well, there are all sorts of different proposals here. You have, you know, one is for, you know, instead of pricing electricity based on the so-called marginal price, you base it on the price bid, or you have an average price, or you split the market essentially into renewables on the one hand and fossil fuel sources on the other, and you have different pricing mechanisms in each. So there's a whole raft of suggestions. I want to just make three brief comments about this. So the first is to say that all of those alternative recommendations have their own flaws and drawbacks. None of them is ideal. All of them have potential disadvantages as well as advantages. That's the first thing I want to say. In fact, I want to say four things. Sorry about that, but they'll all be pretty quick. The second thing I want to say is that during the energy crisis in 2021-2022, there was a huge amount of talk, not least in Europe, which was in many respects the heart of the energy crisis, about redesigning electricity markets. Everyone started talking about, well, what, you know, the coupling of electricity and gas prices, as you mentioned, and why do we have this, and we need to redesign it. And there was lots of enthusiasm around among politicians. We'll decouple those things and we'll redesign the electricity market. As soon as the energy crisis ebbed, all that talk disappeared. And the EU, for its part, it essentially kicked the question into the sand when it came up with its recommendations. Its recommendations were for no serious reform at all. I fully expect the same will occur in the UK. Third thing I want to say is, why was that? The reason for that, and this is where there's a kind of dilemma for renewables and the renewables industry, is that moving away from the existing design, it's not clear that that would be good for renewables. And the reason for that is that the coupling of electricity pricing to gas pricing, which doesn't mean that electricity prices are always pegged to gas prices, but they are pegged to gas prices much more of the time than would be suggested by the amount of electricity that is produced through gas. And there's complex reasons for that that we don't need to get into. But if you were to move away from that, you would potentially impair the incentive for investment in new renewables, because the coupling of gas to gas pricing, when gas prices are high, that keeps electricity prices up. And higher electricity prices is an incentive, not a disincentive, to new renewables investment. And what lots of people have shown is that the more you allow electricity prices in the market as a whole to be influenced by renewables prices with their support from subsidy mechanisms, the more you potentially end up with what's called a cannibalization effect, where basically the growing influence of renewables has this paradoxical impact of undermining the conditions of its own reproduction, because it pulls down electricity prices and therefore reduces the incentive to invest. So that's the third thing to say is that, and I think that's why policymakers have rowed back, is once they start to look into this, they're like, oh shit, that wasn't such a good idea after all. Fourth thing, and it's a much more general point, is that idea of market redesign is always mainstream economists' answer, right? For mainstream economists, the answer is never that the problem was with using markets and relying on the private sector in the first place. The answer is always not that markets created this problem, it's that we haven't got the market right. And this is just another, to my mind, another iteration of that, rather than actually confronting the question, well, actually, should we be relying exclusively on the private sector and markets, with a bit of nudging from government in the first place? That broader question is just a no-go area for the mainstream.
Okay, thanks for that. Now, I just want to move on to another area now, that of transmission of power and the location of power generation. Yes. To the demand.
Yes.
Now, one of the key issues facing renewables that you've noticed is the cost of delivering the power to where it is from where it is generated to where it is consumed. Now, in a recent interview with Bloomberg, you stated, for renewables, the delivery costs tend to be higher than they are for conventional power plants, because conventional power plants, on average, tend to be located closer to centres of demand. That's because, unlike conventional power plants, renewables like solar and wind farms require huge amounts of land, produce significant amounts of power. Now, recently, University College London published a report which looked at the potential for siting solar PV systems on rooftops.
Yeah.
And car parks in the UK.
Yep.
They found that over 60 gigawatts could be placed on domestic roofs, over 40 gigawatts on non-domestic rooftops, and over 10 gigawatts on car parks, which totaling up, they got 120 gigawatts, which could be installed in the built environment. That is where the demand is.
Yep.
Now, this compares to the 90 gigawatts total required to achieve the UK's net zero 2050 target. So my question is this: doesn't the huge potential of rooftop and car park solar generation, which can be located closer to demand, undermine your argument about the impact of land and transmission costs on limiting the speed of take-up of renewables?
I don't think it undermines it. I mean, I think that the question of rooftop solar, and it is typically solar, which is a subset of what is more generally referred to as distributed renewable energy resources. So rather than centralized kind of utility scale, large scale wind or solar farms, you have distributed resources on rooftops and so on, is a really, really important one. And actually, you know, the thing I would point to there is China, where, so in the last couple of years, China has installed vast quantities of new solar and wind capacity, but particularly solar, a significant amount of which has been precisely rooftop solar. So it is happening, absolutely, and it can happen under the right political and economic conditions. I guess I would have. There are two things I would want to say about this, and it's more questions I would kind of come back with than answers per se. So I think the first question for me, and I'll readily admit that the question of rooftop is not one I have specifically examined in enough detail. I need to do that. So the first is a question around to what extent are those predictions realistic given social, political and economic constraints about the capacity that exists for rooftop to substitute for more centralised forms of renewable energy generation? There's clearly more capacity there, but to what extent are, you know, private property owners and so on willing for that, willing to finance it, or to what extent is the government willing to subsidise that investment? In China, you know, the rooftop solar revolution of the last couple of years has been heavily subsidised by government. Is the UK government willing to do so in a similar way? So on and so forth. So there's a question there about the capacity that exists for that, for it to supplement it. The second question is kind of related to that, and it's kind of a deeper question in a way, which is to say the following, which is that one of the main reasons why individuals or communities are interested in developing their own renewable resources like rooftop solar is precisely to enhance their ability to become less dependent on the grid. It's precisely in order to enhance their ability to produce their own energy rather than relying on energy that has to be created and then bought commercially. And in many cases, that the ultimate endpoint of that is going off grid, for whether that's for communities or for individuals. Now, in theory, that's all well and good, right? But as Australia has begun to find, to the best of my knowledge, there's a problem there, which is like the more that communities and individuals go off grid, the more that the costs of that grid, its maintenance, its operation, and so on and so forth, have to be borne by a falling number of individuals and communities. If some are going off grid, then the grid is a classic social resource, right? It's a socialized resource whose costs are borne across the population of generators and consumers. And so, in a way, there's a problem with people going off grid and with local renewable generation, which is that those costs have to get amortised across a smaller number of people, which ultimately means, I think, because consumers aren't going to be willing to bear those costs, it means government subsidy in another form. So I don't think there's a kind of quote unquote free lunch here, if you see what I mean. I think people often forget this fact that the grid is like the classic social resource, and it, in a way, it needs to remain a social resource. And any developments that impair that socialisation are, in some respects, can be problematic. Now, that's not an answer, but it's two questions that I think I don't necessarily have answers to, and I'm not convinced that we have the necessary answers to yet.
Okay, thanks. Now, that's a good point to come into my next point, which is about government support for renewables, which
yes.
you have touched on already.
Yes.
But I just want to focus on that a little bit more now, public sector stroke government support. Now, the main crux of your argument is that left to its own devices, private capital will not usher in a rapid transition to renewables. You said that government have asked the private sector to do the heavy lifting of substituting clean for dirty energy, while the role of government remains limited to providing incentives of various kinds, such as long-term revenue guarantees in the UK's case, as we've already mentioned, tax credits in the US.
Yeah.
The private sector, you say, is not seen as part of the answer, but as the whole answer.
Yeah.
Now, this approach, you say, will not lead to a rapid transition to renewable energy. Now, my question is this. How do you shift away from a situation where the private sector is being seen as the whole answer to one where the state, the public sector, is itself becoming part of the answer? What's the mix? What's the way forward, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now, the way you've put it, I think that is where we're at right now, which is that with exceptions, like China being the obvious exception, in most parts of the world, that is how it's working. Which is to say, governments have basically said to the private sector, look, you do the development, you own the solar and wind farms, you sell the electricity and make your revenues and profits. Our role is simply to provide support and subsidy mechanisms to make the business sufficiently competitive that the investment will occur. That's kind of where we're at. And as I say in the book, the problem is that's not working fast enough across most parts of the world. And I think that's clearly the case. Now, in theory, there are three... If you assume that we are going to continue to need huge investment, which I think is a fair assumption. People that argue for what you might call degrowth would say, well, part of the answer is on the demand side. It's just reducing our demand across the globe, being less obsessed with economic growth, reducing our consumption, so forth. Nice idea, whether that's going to happen in practice is moot. But if we assume continued need for huge investment in renewables capacity, I think there are broadly three answers out there, one of which we've already touched on, which is the mainstream economist answer, which is that the model we have right now, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that we haven't got the market design right. Personally, I don't believe that argument, but that's one argument. Second answer is to say, let's keep with our existing model, but let's buy Brett's argument that with the existing support and subsidy mechanisms, the profit is not enticing enough on a big enough scale to stimulate development on the scale and at the speed we need, to which the answer is governments need to do more. They need to offer more incentives, they need to offer better incentives, and so in order to incentivize capital to front up on a much more significant scale and more rapidly than they currently are. That's a possible answer. But the third answer, which is kind of the one you're hinting at, is that governments have an alternative, which is instead of saying we are going to limit our role to supporting the private sector, we will make energy development, energy generation, part of our own remit. We will borrow, finance, invest, and own and operate renewable energy resources ourselves. These will be public sector businesses on a much more significant scale than they currently are.
So go back to where we were 100 years ago, Victorian times.
Yeah, I mean, yes, when energy was more publicly owned in most parts of the world than it is now. I mean, if you look at the data, something like in OECD countries at any rate, in what you might call the developed world, global north, something like 90-95% of renewables development is currently in the hands of the private sector. So the public sector plays a role through things like Vattenfall, the Swedish company, and others, but it's a limited role. It's predominantly the private sector. So yes, the public sector could do more. And let's be clear, there have been some very strong proposals along those lines from very influential politicians. So the so-called Green New Deal, as it was originally formulated in the US by Bernie Sanders, in the UK by Jeremy Corbyn, had public ownership of energy, and in particular renewable energy, as its kind of central plank. That's been watered down in more mainstream centrist versions of the Green New Deal in recent years. But there have been, and in many places still are, very strong proposals along those lines. Now, I guess I would have the following to say about those things in relation to the question you asked about it. The first thing is to say that I think that if anything along those lines is going to happen, and is going to make any real difference, it would have to happen on a large scale. And one of the reasons I say that is simply that, you know, having a few more publicly owned renewable generation companies, like the one that Labour is talking about in the UK, so-called Great British Energy, that isn't going to make a damn bit of difference when the industry as a whole is still dominated by the private sector, and you have exactly the same mechanisms for buying and selling electricity as we do today, dominated by the same interests. And so, you know, one relatively small publicly owned entity might sound good, but if that entity is kind of a gnat on the hide of the beast of the private sector, it ain't going to make a damn bit of difference to climate and emissions at the broad scale. That's the first thing to say. So it would have to be done on a significant scale. I think the second thing I would say, though, is this, which is that there, in my view, and in a way, this is, I think, one of the most important things I can say, is that in my view, there is a fundamental mismatch globally between those parts of the world in which governments have a realistic capacity to be able to do that type of thing, on the one hand, and on the other hand, those parts of the world where the need for future investment in clean energy capacity is greatest. So let me expand a bit on what I mean by that. So I think that in the US, for example, or in the UK, or in many parts of Europe, which are still rich countries, you know, despite us being told, you know, the governments are operating under, you know, constraints about how much they can borrow and invest. The reality is that the UK government, if it chose to, could still borrow for investment in revenue-generating resources like energy-generating companies at very, very attractive rates, despite the fact that it likes to tell itself it couldn't. It could, and so could the US government, and so could the German government. So there's an ideology of, you know, the need for belt tightening and so on. But these are rich countries with significant fiscal capacity. But these are also the countries where, yes, a lot remains to be done on climate and renewables, but lots of countries in Europe, and indeed large parts of North America, are actually already quite a significant way along the road. Now, there are other parts of the world where vastly more remains to be done in terms of renewable energy investment, partly because those energy sectors currently remain more dependent on fossil fuels. So India, something like 75% of electricity generation is coal. South Africa, something like 90%. Nigeria, 95%. Not only are they much more reliant still on fossil fuels, but that's where growth in energy demand in the future is going to be concentrated. So for those two reasons, that's where the demand for investment is by far the greatest, is in non-global north parts of the world. However, those also tend to be the countries in which governments are operating under much greater fiscal constraints than the UK or the US or France or Germany or wherever else it might be. So where the need for investment is greatest is where it's hardest for governments to conceive of, let alone implement, significant public borrowing, financing, investment and ownership and operation. And to me, that's the real issue, I think. And irrespective of whether we're talking about public investment, it's the same in terms of private investment. One of the main reasons that investment in renewables in the global south has been and continues to go much slower than in the global north is that the cost of capital is multiple times higher. So a renewables developer might be able to borrow at 5% to develop a wind farm in the UK or in Sweden, but they'll be looking at 12 or 13 or 14% in parts of Africa and Southeast Asia and Indonesia or in Zambia or in the Senegal. And that's not necessarily because the risk is actually greater, it's because the perception of risk is greater, and the perception of risk is what matters. If financial institutions think that there is a greater risk there, irrespective of whether the risk is greater, they will charge for it. And so renewables developers can't get projects across the ground in those parts of the world because capital is simply much more expensive. And so I think there's this huge kind of geographical mismatch right now in the world between the ability of projects to occur and the need for those projects to occur. And the public ownership, the public investment question is part of that, but it's only part of it.
Let's just come to this issue of state support. Now, one of the big problems of state support or intervention is that the cost, certainly in the short and medium terms, is usually borne by taxpayers.
Yes.
Which is hard and unpopular when many governments face slow and declining economic growth.
Yeah.
Now, just going forwards with this sort of argument, there is another argument, and a strong one perhaps, that addressing the impacts of climate change, because this is what we're talking about here with renewables versus fossil fuels,
yeah.
The climate emergency, and the impact fossil fuels are having on the environment. So there's an argument, a strong one, that addressing the impacts of climate change offers some incredible business opportunities which can help fuel economic growth and wealth creation, which can cover the cost of borrowing and take the burden off the taxpayer.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Now, in your view, does such an argument hold water? Can the implementation of renewable energy to replace fossil fuels become an engine of economic growth more broadly? Isn't this the approach which the US is taking with the Inflation Reduction Act? Or is there more to it? Does there have to be a strong vision held by those in government which can motivate the electorate?
It's a great question. I have a significant degree of scepticism on that front about that story. I think that the idea that renewables can be kind of an engine of economic growth, I think is a tenuous one. I think that as the China example shows, I think to the extent that there is significant kind of industrial / economic growth potential, it's more on the manufacturing side than on the energy generation side.
But doesn't cheaper energy generation make for more efficient manufacturing?
It does, but China has. But I think my scepticism here is the fact that for most countries, that kind of idea of a virtuous circle is kind of pie in the sky. Given that China has such a lead now on the manufacturing front, I mean, I think the Inflation Reduction Act there, that's what they're finding. I mean, there's all sorts of obstacles to actually instigating that clean tech sort of revolution in the US, given how far ahead China is, given the preference, which is completely understandable for developers in the US to continue to source their modules and so on from China because it's cheaper to do so, even though there are incentives within the Inflation Reduction Act to do that. So I think that story, which I can understand why politicians like to tell that story, because it sounds like a good story, I'm skeptical about it. However, that's not to say that I don't think that, let me be clear about this, that's not to say that I don't think that public borrowing for public investment in renewable energy generation is a perfectly good idea. But I don't think we should be selling on the idea that this is going to be a major economic win. But here's the thing, right? If renewables are not massively profitable, that doesn't necessarily matter. As long as they're profitable enough for the public sector to kind of be able to wash its face in terms of paying back debt, which can be raised relatively cheaply, then that's fine. It doesn't need to be a huge profit opportunity. As long as it's clear that these are revenue generating assets, which will service that debt over the long term, I think that's fine. And that's a completely reasonable story to be told. But it has to be told as part of a story with, as you put it, a much wider vision. And at the end of the day, I think politicians, end up getting themselves in a bit of a pickle when they sell decarbonisation and the energy transition as this kind of marvellous economic opportunity where there's, you know, where there aren't going to be costs to the taxpayer and there are these enormous gains to be had. When I'm not convinced that's true, the reason to decarbonise is for climate reasons at the end of the day, and that's what we should be pushing on, like it or not. And if you can add a certain kind of common sense economic story to that, then that's fine, but I don't think we should be leading with the economic story.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned China. You say in your book that the one bright spot for renewables is China.
Yeah.
What are the lessons that we in the West, the North, can learn from China, which can be of benefit to our future well-being?
That's a difficult question as well.
Is there anything?
Which I'll preface by saying, you know, China is nothing if not contradictory, and that yes, you know, China is the one bright spot in the sense that, you know, the vast majority of growth of growth in the last couple of years in the rate at which renewable energy capacity is being developed across the world, the most of that growth is occurring in China. So it's there that the speed of investment is ratcheting up fastest. However, and this is what I mean by contradiction, China is also the place where most of the world's new coal-fired power plants are being installed as well. So China is kind of leading on everything.
But they're new for old, aren't they? They're less dirty.
Yeah, but they're still coal-fired power
plants. Yeah, sure.
And so China is leading on the clean, but it's also leading on the dirty. And there's obvious reasons for that, right? Which is that China is in a very different position in its demand curve in terms of energy than we in Europe are. And yes, it can develop lots of renewables capacity, but that renewables capacity can't necessarily provide the kind of peak loading potential and
base
so on.
Load
exactly
so-called, yeah.
that is required. So it makes sense that it's contradictory. Now, what can the rest of the world learn from China? I mean, I think there is an interesting lesson there, which is that the model there is very different. So most new renewables development is being undertaken by companies that are state-owned. Something like 90-95%, for example, of new wind development is by state-owned companies. Some people would argue, and have argued, that China's state-owned companies have become more independent of the state. They've become more marketized. They've become more attentive and attuned to the profit motive. I think that that's debatable, the extent to which that's true, particularly in the energy sector. As I read it, those state-owned energy companies remain, to a significant extent, tools of the state. Nationally as well as regionally, and to a significant extent tools of Beijing, such that when Beijing decides that it wants X 100 new gigawatts of renewable capacity installed, it happens because Beijing makes it happen. Now, going back to what we were talking about earlier, that's just not the case in the West. In the West, we are, for renewable development to occur, we are relying upon decisions made by a whole array of different actors kind of coming together in a coordinated fashion and ending up with that result, which is an entirely different mechanism of economic coordination than the kind of top-down decision-making that you see in China. And like it or not, the top-down decision-making in China can and does get things done much quicker and arguably much more efficiently and effectively than the system that we have decided to create in recent decades in the West. And do I think that if the UK had still the Central Electricity Generating Board, for example, where electricity was essentially, the whole thing was done under one roof, essentially, that if the political desire and the financial wherewithal was there, twitch like that into renewables, it could be done much quicker than it can be done today with this kind of unbundled, disaggregated supply chain where you have generators here and you have the national grid and you have the local distribution companies and you have retailers, and you rely on these kind of opaque government mechanisms to try and incentivize the right decisions in the right places, and those decisions lining up with...
And you can't have commonality of ownership of these different assets.
Exactly. And so the lesson we should be learning is that planning, centralized planning, like it or hate it, can do certain things that markets and autonomous disaggregated actors can't do very quickly, and arguably won't do at all.
Right.
To the extent that we need.
We've got to start drawing to a close now. Just a couple of brief questions here now. When it comes to solar power generation, geographical factors undoubtedly have a role to play, a key role. Now, recently, the International Renewable Energy Agency data they published shows that given the UK's climate, solar energy is within the worst 5% of areas in the world to develop solar electricity. I mean, there's just not enough sunlight here. Like, we've got to face it.
Yep.
Compared to, say, double the capacity of the solar farms in places like Spain, Australia, or southern US. Now, there are other ways to decarbonize the electricity supply. It doesn't have to be renewables. It could be what a lot of people now call clean energy. And I'm thinking of nuclear.
Yeah.
And I'm not thinking of size, well, B, C-size reactors. I'm thinking of what the ideas that Rolls-Royce and others are coming up with, small modular reactors.
Yeah.
Variations on submarine reactors, essentially. Now, Rolls-Royce has done a lot of work in this, and the UK government's been pretty lukewarm.
Yeah.
A lot of talk, not much happening.
Yeah.
My question is that given, you know, the North's lack of sunshine as a whole, and this has got to influence the profitability of solar generation. Shouldn't there be more emphasis on small nuclear than there is at the moment?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think that the nuclear is a really interesting one. And certainly I think the reality globally, not just in the UK, but globally, is that where we're at right now is that there is a general expectation amongst what you might call the powers that be, by which I mean policy makers, but also decision makers within the private sector, that the bulk of the answer to the power decarbonisation question will be renewables, but there's certainly a recognition that nuclear has a role to play and will continue to have a role to play. But it's seen to be, but again, both in the UK and globally, a relatively limited role. And as you hinted at, so most of the kind of burden of decarbonisation is being placed on the shoulders of renewables. Now, I think there's been a little bit of a revival of interest in nuclear in recent years, not least since the European energy crisis and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I think that it kind of has led to a certain reappraisal in certain quarters of nuclear. But for all that, I do get the sense that that it's only been a mini kind of renaissance, which I think is the impression you get as well. I think, you know, I don't see any... I think probably there could be and should be a greater role for nuclear than people are currently imagining. I think that part of the reason there isn't is precisely because of, and this goes back to right where we began the interview, because of this misconception, and it is a misconception, that solar and wind are really, really cheap and everything about them is cheap. And as I said, that is a misconception because the generating technology might now be cheap, but the wider costs, when you factor in electricity delivery costs and when you factor in the storage requirements that are required to deal with intermittency, and when you factor in the transmission upgrades that are required because of the geographic, all of that stuff means that solar and wind aren't cheap in their totality. And it's that totality that is almost never looked at. And I think, but I think because of that misconception that they're very, very cheap, is one of the reasons why nuclear continues to be frowned upon, because nuclear in no shape or form is cheap. And I think the other thing with nuclear, and I think the newer, you know, again, I'm no expert on this, I think with the newer modular reactors, this is less of a concern, but it takes time with nuclear. It, you know, solar and wind can take a long time to get through the planning process and to raise financing, to get planning permits and to get grid connections and so on. But nuclear takes awfully longer, not least in terms of physical development of the resources. You know, once you've got your permits for solar and wind, it's 6 months or so for an onshore facility to be up and running, whereas with nuclear, you're looking at 5 to 10 years. And the climate emergency is nothing if not an emergency. So the temporal urgency of it is, I think, another thing that weighs against nuclear. And I find that understandable as well. And then, of course, you know, in many countries like Germany and so on, there are just wider kind of public perception concerns around nuclear, fears around safety that have never gone away, despite the fact that statistically nuclear is, of course, a very safe form of power, statistically.
Okay, now, final question. Given their central role in the climate emergency, I'd just like to ask you about the role of the oil majors in the transition to renewable energy. Now, in a 2022 article you published in New Political Economy, Fossilized Capital, Price and Profit in the Energy Transition, you reference the significance of three of the main five oil majors, Shell, BP and Total, to the transition to renewable energy, because they straddle the fossil fuel and the renewable energy worlds. Can you summarise what you believe is the significance of these companies to achieving a transition to a clean and renewable energy world? And finally, following that, what about the other two, ExxonMobil and Chevron? They've done a little bit in the renewable world, but not a lot.
Until around 2018-19, I suppose, there had been a long time when none of those five big Western oil and gas majors were doing anything significant in the renewable space. They'd kind of tinkered with it in the 1980s to varying extents, and they'd realised that it was never a business that didn't look like it was going to be a business where they could earn anything like the money they earn in their traditional business, and so they kind of shuttered those experimental divisions. But then, with the kind of growing climate concerns, there was a divergence in the late 2010s, strategically, between North America and Europe, where the North American majors, Exxon and Chevron, essentially said, forget about renewables, they're still not profitable enough for us, we are doubling down on our traditional businesses, and you can quote us on it. In Europe, something different happened, I think, because for all sorts of different reasons, because of greater political concern about climate questions, because of greater concerns about those ESG sort of criteria amongst the investment community than you tended to have in the US, all three of the European majors, BP, Shell and Total, began to talk quite a good game about the transition. They all began to say, we recognise we can't continue to be what we are ad infinitum. We recognise that by 2050 we need to be very different types of companies than we are now. And now we are beginning the transition to something else. We are going to beef up our clean energy stuff. We're going to do more in renewables. And that is the beginning of a process whereby we're going to end up not being fossil fuel companies anymore. Now, what happened, lots of things happened over the subsequent years, but one of the main things that happened over subsequent years, and this goes back to your question earlier about shareholders in these types of business, was that the share prices of Exxon and Chevron kept going up. The share prices of BP, Shell and Total all tanked. And whether or not this was true or not, the belief became and was that they tanked precisely because of them being seen to pivot away from their very traditional oil and gas businesses. And then what happened in the last year or so, is that they've all kind of rowed back. So BP, Shell and Total have all affected, they've hired new chief executives, and they, in all cases, they've essentially said, we were being too hasty. We are going to, and they've said it either implicitly or explicitly, we are going to pivot back to being much more focused on oil and gas than we led you to believe that we would be, which is very, very depressing. And it's very depressing not just not just because that's what they're doing, but I think for a more fundamental reason, which is this, which is that I think the reason they're doing that, one of the big reasons, not only because of the share price tanking, but I think they've looked at what's happening politically. And I think that they have decided that the concern that they had that governments were going to be fairly serious and maybe even draconian about regulating their traditional businesses out of business, about introducing proper carbon taxes, and about preventing the development of new oil and gas fields, I think they've looked at politicians and said, no, they're not serious about it at all. They're letting us develop new oil and gas fields willy-nilly, wherever we like. So actually, our concerns about some of our new assets becoming stranded or whatever it might be in 10, 20, 30 years' time, those concerns were unfounded. So actually, we're just going to go back to what we were doing because governments have shown that they're not serious about it.
Right. Okay. Well, I'd like to draw the discussion to a close now, and it just remains to say, Professor Brett Christophers, thank you so much for participating in this podcast.
Thank you for talking to me. I appreciate it very much.